The Investment Trust Show, brought to you by Henderson Global Investors, managing investment trusts since 1934.
Yes, it's time now for our regular weekly programme, The Investment Trust Show, brought to you in association with Henderson Global Investors. With me in this year to help quiz our guest is Ed Bauscher, our senior analyst. As each week we explore the main features, factors and developments affecting investment trusts. And this week we're going to concentrate on one trust, the F&C Capital and Income Trust. I'm glad to say we've got its manager, Julian Kane, in the studio with us. Welcome. You've been managing the fund for 20 years, I understand. Now, let's just look at the title first, capital and income. I mean, obviously investors would love to have lots of both, but what's more important from your point of view?
Well, it's a very good observation. I mean, we have twin objectives. It's we want to try and increase the dividend each and every year, and we've done that ever since I've been in charge, and in fact, going back a little bit further from launch as well in 93. So on the dividend side, shareholders have been very well looked after. And the capital as well. We benchmark capital against the all-share index. We invest primarily in UK companies. And we aim to beat that over time. And we've done that as well. So it seems a bit like cake and eat it, but that's what we aim for. We want to push up the dividend and for capital to grow over time.
So that's essentially looking at the very long term, whereas we've talked many times, Ed, investors will often not really think about the compounding of their dividends. And if you do look at the long term, the fact you're producing income will give you the capital growth. Otherwise, those shares would be out of kilter with the rest of the market.
Very much so, yes. So our objective is very much to make sure that our earnings and the dividend that we pay goes up year after year. Mm. And we sometimes, you know, we'll focus perhaps on out of favour stocks which have been ignored by the stock market or unpopular. But we believe that by focusing on fundamentals and looking at cash flow, that we have confidence that they can increase those dividends. And actually, as those companies, their characteristics perhaps come back into favour, you can see that it's often a bit of a rebound. So the capital catches up. And certainly for our investors, by reinvesting their dividends back into the trust, you can see there's been very, very strong performance over time. But if you look at the fundamentals, the theory, over very long periods of time, stock market returns have very much been driven by dividend yield and by dividend growth. Actually, whether ratings change much over time is a sort of a moot point. And certainly, there's not much evidence over 30 or 40 years that ratings have changed, if you look at PE or dividend yield.
Yes.
But it's the importance of that dividend and the growth and compounding it back into the share price that really drives returns.
Has it become more difficult of late to find solid income that you can depend on and where you're not slightly worried that it's suddenly going to vanish?
Yeah, well, it's certainly true that at the largest, the mega cap end of the spectrum, that dividend yield on companies has held up well. The yield has held up well while earnings have been under pressure. So the dividend cover has been much reduced. If you look at the FTSE 100, the raw statistics will tell you that dividends are only just about covered. And a big part of that is to do with commodity prices, particularly oil. Shell and BP, clearly, that's what they produce. And so their earnings have been depressed by the low oil price. And banks have been under pressure too. So companies like HSBC have kept their dividend steady at a time while earnings have been under pressure. So if you look at the mega cap end of the spectrum, yes, dividends are only just about covered by earnings, but we try to have a very balanced portfolio. And by looking at the bottom end of the FTSE 100 or mid cap or small cap, you can find companies which have a much better ability to grow their dividends.
So you worried that any of the big mega caps might cut their dividends in the near future then?
It's certainly a possibility that we wouldn't discount. And the oil companies have been pretty clear on their willingness, their desire to try and keep those dividends and keep dividends moving ahead. But at the end of the day, they are vulnerable to changes in the oil price, and they can't control the oil price. Saudi Arabians, maybe they can influence the oil price, but it's very difficult. So when you're dealing with a commodity like that, inevitably, we as investors have less confidence than we might do in companies who are more in control of their own destiny.
Now, you said you were willing to look, you know, anywhere to find this, or virtually anywhere to find the income. Looking at your top 10 holdings, which include Shell and BP, quite a lot of very big sort of FTSE beasts. But I noticed one savings bank was in there as well, which seems a little, slightly sort of a bit of an outlier. Why are you interested in that?
Certainly, if you look at the absolute positions of the fund, you will find a reasonable number of mega cap stocks in there. If you looked at the active positions, our positions relative to the benchmark, you would find that the majority of our biggest active positions are outside of the FTSE 100. And certainly one savings bank is one of those. In our analysis, we thought it'd be very interesting to look at some of these challenger banks as they came to the market. And it seemed to us that one savings bank had a very good combination of very high returns, a very low cost base, and growth. It's very much a specialist in what it does, lending primarily to the buy-to-let market. And although that area has come under a bit of political pressure because of the whole issue of whether people can afford to buy and renting, although there's some political pressure, actually what that's probably done is it's deterred some of the bigger players and allowed the specialists a bit more room for growth. So we're very confident that it can produce a good balance of returns and growth over time.
And I'm interested, you've only got one of the big banks in the top 10, HSBC. What's your attitude towards the other ones, people like Lloyds and Barclays? I do worry that they are really going to suffer as the years go on against the likes of One Savings, because they're lumbered with the huge costs of these big branch networks. Mm. That's what makes me more reluctant than anything else now to go into some of the big high street banks.
It's certainly true. They have a very high cost infrastructure compared to others. I mean, One Savings Bank doesn't have a retail presence at all. Its products, the mortgages, are sold via brokers, via intermediaries. And its savings it takes on directly. It's an online presence through Kent Reliance. So it avoids that cost base. It has a low cost outsourced centre in India, which again, although some of the other high street banks will outsource some of their operations, they won't outsource as much as One Savings. So that's a strong part of why we like that model. But I do think that Lloyds is in some ways a proxy for the UK economy. I think it's the UK economy is not as badly positioned perhaps as some people thought. For the most part, lending growth is being done at reasonably conservative levels. And Lloyds will have more cost to take out. Yes, they have this branch infrastructure, but I think they're obviously very aware of that, and they have long-term programs to try and reduce that as and when they can.
I mean, since we're talking about financials, 31% of the trust is in the sort of financial sector.
It is.
So and that's quite intriguing.
That does appear a large number because we are underweight in the biggest banks. But we do have more exposure through some of the smaller financials. Mm. One Savings Bank, Arrow Global would be another one that you wouldn't perhaps find in a number of other funds. It buys bad debts off originators, banks or telecom companies, whoever it might be. So if you've defaulted on a loan, the chances are that might be sold on to Arrow or one of its competitors. Arrow, of course, pays a pretty modest sum for those bad debts, typically pennies in a pound, 8, 9, 10p for that bad debt, and then aims to recover it. So it's a very niche, very specialist business. It's come out of private equity. It's got good growth characteristics, very high returns, and a very high market share. So, we're very confident in that. We also invest in Intermediate Capital, which is a specialist provider of mezzanine finance to businesses. So it's neither providing equity nor senior debt, but it's mezzanine finance. It's somewhere in between. Mm. Very, very good long-term track record, and again, driving very strong returns. So we've got quite a high exposure to financials, but they're not necessarily through some of the big names that you might know very well. We've also got a reasonable exposure to the life assurance sector. We think returns there are pretty attractive. It's quite a consolidated market in many ways. I mean, we cannot think of Legal & General, Prudential, Aviva, Standard Life. There are a smallish number of very big providers, but the returns that they have been generating between them are pretty attractive. So Legal & General, their returns have been increasing strongly over time. It's one of the companies, in fact, you know, we've looked back over the last decade. It's one of the businesses we've held over that period. And despite the financial crisis, the share price has really been very strong. And importantly for us, its dividends have increased very strongly over the period too. So financials covers a raft of
yes.
different businesses. There is some correlation, I guess, between them, and we're aware of that when we put the portfolio together. But they are distinctly different, operating in many different areas.
Are there any other particular sectors that you find interesting? Clearly, you're exploring the financial sector for finding things that mainstream funds may not go into. What about other sectors? Where are you finding interest?
In general, we tend not to think too much about sectors. I mean, we've right. just clearly been talking about one because there is a subgroup
yes.
of companies which have interesting characteristics, and they happen to be in the financial sector. But our portfolio is very much driven by stock selection, so we look very carefully at the underlying companies. We assess their financial stability. And importantly, for thinking about our valuations, we look at the cash flow of those businesses, look at what they've produced in the past, and try to come up with some forecasts and estimates as to what they can do in the future. So we have a smattering of exposure to engineering type companies. Melrose has been one of the most successful that we've invested in recent years. They have a very clear management philosophy. They treat it very much as a private equity business. So they buy businesses which they perceive as being fundamentally undermanaged. They look to improve those, and then they will sell them on either to the stock market through IPOs or to other trade buyers. So it's a very distinct management philosophy that they have, and they've driven amazing returns out of the businesses that they've purchased. So that would be another sort of group, and we've some other engineering businesses in there as well that we think are interesting.
I'm talking to Julian Kane, who is the manager of the F&C Capital and Income Trust. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Investment Trust Show, brought to you by Henderson Global Investors, managing investment trusts since 1934.
Managing the F&C Capital and Income Trust for the last 20 years is Julian Kane, who's here in the studio, as indeed is Ed Bauscher, our senior analyst. Ed, perhaps you would just give us the performance numbers for the trust.
Yes, so these are performance numbers for the trust's net asset value, NAV. So it's not the share price, it's looking at the value of the underlying portfolio. Over 1 year, it's risen 18.8%, over 3 years, 25.7%, and over 5 years, 65.5%. The other point to make is this is about the capital value. It's not telling you how much or how little income investors may have been getting every year from the fund.
Okay, Ed, thank you. So, Julian, the investment trust structure itself, is that, from your point of view, of any help in managing the fund?
Very much so. I've clearly managed this trust for 20 years, and over that period I've seen a number of the advantages of the investment trust structure come to play. First and foremost, I think the independent board structure is a safeguard for shareholders. Certainly in my experience, the chairman and the board operate only ever in the interests of shareholders, not in the interests of the managers. Mm. But it is obviously completely separate from that. And the board have been nothing but active in trying to promote the interests of shareholders. So going back a long time, shortly after I took over the management of the trust, the share price stood at a substantial discount to the asset value, and that at the time was not exceptional. Most investment trusts stood at big discounts to the asset value, and there was sort of a collective industry thought that's how the world always was and how it should be, and there wasn't much could be done about it. My board thought rather differently. They said, well, this fund invests across the UK in fairly blue chip companies, mostly in the All Share. Why should it trade at a substantial discount? We can see tracker funds out there. We can see OEICs trading, or unit trusts trading at asset value. Why should this be different? And in 1999, they took the view that we should have a fairly aggressive buyback policy, and they would buy back shares until the share price traded much more closely in line with the asset value. And over the course of a couple of years, that buyback policy really started to bite, and the discount moved from close to 20 to much closer to where it is now. We've been trading at around asset value for a good number of years. And that seems to be, I'm touching wood, a relatively stable situation. But if the discount were to widen out again, then the current board, I'm sure, would step in to restart that buyback program.
I know for those listeners who aren't as familiar with investment trusts as some may be, Ed is champing at the bit just to explain what the discount is.
Yes, so the idea being that with investment trusts, unlike OEICs, unlike passive tracker funds, the share price doesn't always move in line with the net asset value. They're two separate things. And so that's why you can get these big discounts where the share price might be 20% lower than the underlying value of the portfolio. You might get a premium where it's 10% higher. As Julian says, the discount on his trust has narrowed. And that's what we've seen really in broad terms across the investment trust sector in recent years.
Thank you, Ed. 20 years you've been managing the trust. How's the income investing landscape changed? I mean, we've lived through some quite extraordinary times, and during that period, by and large, interest rates have just come down and down and down.
Yeah.
So what's that meant from your point of view?
Going back 20 years ago, I reread my the annual report from that period, and it talked about interest rates having gone up half a dozen times. They were at 7.5%. Mm. The landscape was completely different. Mm. And as you point out, with a couple of blips, the interest rates have been pretty well down that whole period. But our yield and the yield on the all-share generally has been sort of within a range of 3-4% throughout that period. So 20 years ago, although investors liked the dividend yield, it wasn't even as much as you would get on cash.
Yeah.
So I think there was a sense that people invested in shares for capital growth much more than yield. Yield was nice, but it wasn't a must-have. And of course, that situation has rather changed. In more recent years, the returns on cash are so derisory that perhaps people have gone into shares for the dividend yield, and you can get multiples of the income that you would get in a bank from shares.
Because that does worry me a bit. I mean, I completely understand why people are fed up with the interest rates they're getting on their savings accounts. I do wonder if some people came into shares quite naively looking for a higher rate and perhaps didn't realise the risk they were taking on. But of course, as long as you do understand that risk, obviously these kind of yields are fantastic. And it is astonishing to think 20 years ago that the dividend yields were less than interest rates. Quite
yes,
amazing,
indeed.
Really.
And what about the future then? And we're expecting interest rates to rise, at least in the States, and eventually if they do rise there, they'll have to follow here at some point. So what's the picture looking ahead, do you think, from the income point of view?
Well, inevitably the future is uncertain, but I think you're right to suggest that there is likely to be a bit more of a headwind. So falling interest rates, falling bond yields clearly have allowed or given a bit of a tailwind to shares. I think everyone would accept that. And in a sense, that is a deliberate part of the quantitative easing program, is to bring down yields, to make real assets appear more attractive. So really the market's response that the share price has gone up is entirely logical. The reverse of that must also be true, that as some of the financial support gets reduced, as of when interest rates increase in the UK, then it will make the going a little bit more difficult for shares. But nonetheless, I think the headline yield on our company or on the market generally at about 3.5% doesn't seem bad value in a long-term context. It's not outstandingly cheap, but neither is it really very expensive. So I think it will come down in future to individual stock selection. It's making sure that you have the right shares within the portfolio to get capital growth, to get the cash and the dividends moving ahead. But some of the big gains that we've had in the past, I think those have been very much driven by the interest rate environment and not likely to be repeated.
The other big elephant in the room, of course, is Brexit. Your fund is about 94% invested in UK, just 3% Europe developed, ex-UK, and then a little bit of
relatively
cash
small
as well.
Amount so, outside the UK, yes.
So it's mostly UK focused. So Brexit presumably was a bit of a help after the referendum. But what about looking forward?
Well, the day after the vote, of course, was anything but a help. We have rather more in mid-cap companies than the FTSE 100. So when the market collapsed the day after the referendum, it was very, very painful, albeit a very short-term pain. As we now know, those stocks have rallied very strongly. If Rip Van Winkle had fallen asleep on the 1st of January, ignored all of 2016, woken up at the end of the year, he would have said, you know, referendum what referendum, and wouldn't have worried too much about it. So we try not to worry over much about the general economic environment. At university, I studied economics, and in a way, it's a fascinating discipline, but it does look more and more like theology. It's people arguing about abstruse concepts. It's really very far removed from the real world. And to worry too much about, you know, growth, you know, whether it's going to be 2, 2.2, 1.8, it doesn't really matter. If the companies are good enough producing good returns, that will far outweigh anything that might be happening at a macro level in terms of the economy. So obviously we would like the economy to do well. That would be a more favourable background, but it's not our central scenario, really. We just try to focus very much on the underlying companies.
And talking of going back to individual companies, in your top 10 list is Unilever, as one might expect, where we have that extraordinary sort of abortive bid recently, and then sort of thought that perhaps the management may be able to realise a little bit more value. What do you feel there? Were you quite happy with Unilever before Kraft Heinz came along?
Absolutely. Unilever's been a long-standing share. We've certainly held it for at least 10 years. And we believe that there is a very good long-term growth story there. They have an attractive product portfolio. They have a good geographic diversification. They should be able to achieve good levels of growth and good returns over time. But I think what Kraft spotted is that the margins at Unilever are relatively low compared to some of its global peers. And there is a discussion to be had between how ruthless a business should be in terms of cutting costs and how much it should be investing for the future. And I think, you know, the two models of Unilever and Kraft are at two ends of that spectrum. So Kraft is ruthlessly run. They have zero budgeting. Everything has to be approved year in, year out. There's no room for slack whatsoever. And that has a very distinctive style and drives very high returns, albeit one that may not have great longevity because they're not investing perhaps as much as others.
Yes.
Unilever is the other end of the spectrum. So I think to the extent that it encourages Unilever to focus a bit more on costs, particularly unnecessary costs, that can only be good. But you know, we fundamentally like the business and would hope that they can respond to the approach from Kraft by upping its game and increasing margins a little bit from here.
Do you find yourself getting involved in corporate governance discussions and wanting to put weight behind various arguments when companies are in the limelight for, I don't know, paying the people who run them extraordinary amounts of money, or for issues of corporate governance that, you know, we get certain companies where it's believed they're not perhaps quite as well behaved as others?
It's certainly a trend that has evolved over the last 20 years. Going back, you know, to the start of my time running this trust, our responsibilities as stewards of the money investing in other businesses was you know, a long way down the list of priorities. It was all about performance,
yes.
And in a way that's correct. It's still very much about performance now, but the board are acutely interested in how we voted in some of the remuneration discussions, what our views are on some of these big topics of the day. So it definitely is a growing trend, and I think rightly so. We at BMO have a large team that look after corporate governance. As and when there are controversial issues that come up, they will discuss those with fund managers such as me, and we will come up with a unified response. But it's right that it's an integral part of what investment management houses do. We do have a responsibility to look after that money in a sensible way.
Well, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. And that's Julian Kane, who's the manager of F&C Capital and Income Trust. Also with us, of course, Ed Bowsher, Sheridan's senior analyst. That's it for this edition of the Investment Trust Show, brought to you in association with Henderson Global Investors.
At Henderson Global Investors, we believe in helping people to make informed investment decisions by sharing our knowledge. We are a proud sponsor of the Investment Trust Show on Share Radio, and we currently manage a range of 13 investment trusts in a wide range of sectors, geographies, and markets across the globe. Visit us at hendersoninvestmenttrusts.com. Henderson Global Investors is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority to provide investment products and services.